There is the phase where you try to salvage something presentable from the output of that wild process. Having oversimplified your task, you count on a meta-level process of self-monitoring to correct or renormalize or improve your final product to some degree. Fifth, there is the endless vulnerability to second-guessing and hindsight wisdom about what you should have done. But done is done. You let the result stand and go on to other things. Life is short. The decision process just described is an instance of the fundamental pattern first explicitly analyzed by Herbert Simon, 1957-1959, who named it satisficing. Notice how the pattern repeats itself, rather like a fractal curve, as we trace down through the sub-decisions, the sub-sub-decisions, and so forth, until the process becomes invisible. At the department meeting called to consider how to deal with this dilemma, A, everyone is bursting with suggestions, more than can be sensibly discussed in the 2 hours allotted, so B, the chairman becomes somewhat peremptory, deciding not to recognize several members who might well, of course, have some very good ideas, and then C, after a brief free-for-all discussion, in which, for all anyone can tell, timing, volume, and timbre may count for more than content, D, the chairman attempts to summarize by picking a few highlights that somehow strike him as the operative points, and the strengths and weaknesses of these are debated in a rather more orderly way, and then a vote is taken. After the meeting, E, there are those who still think that better cut rules could have been chosen, that the department could have afforded the time to evaluate 200 finalists, or should have restricted the number to 20, etc., but done is done. They have learned the important lesson of how to live with the suboptimal decision-making of their colleagues. So, after a few minutes or hours of luxuriating in clever hindsight, they drop it. But should I drop it, you ask yourself, just as you asked yourself the same question in the midst of the free-for-all when the chairman wouldn't call on you? Your head was teeming at that moment, A, with reasons why you should insist on being heard, competing with reasons why you should go along with your colleagues quietly, and all this was competing with your attempts to follow what others were saying and so forth. More information at your fingertips than you could handle. So, B, you swiftly, arbitrarily, and unthinkingly blocked off some of it, running the risk of ignoring the most important considerations. And then C, you gave up trying to control your thoughts. You relinquished meta-control and let your thoughts lead wherever they might for a while. After a bit, you somehow, D, resumed control, attempted some ordering and improving of the materials spewed up by the free-for-all, and made the decision to drop it, suffering E, instant pangs of dubiety and toying with regret, but because you are wise, you shrugged these off as well. And how precisely did you go about dismissing that evanescent and unarticulated micro-wonder, should I have dropped it? Here, the processes become invisible to the naked eye of introspection. But if we look at cognitive science models of decision-making and problem-solving within such swift, unconscious processes as perception and language comprehension, we see further tempting analogs of our phases in the various models of heuristic search and problem-solving. As we have heard again and again in this audiobook, time-pressured decision-making is like that all the way down. Satisficing extends even back behind the fixed biological design of the decision-making agent, to the design decisions that Mother Nature settled for when designing us and other organisms. There may be somewhat non-arbitrary dividing lines to be drawn between biological, psychological, and cultural manifestations of this structure, but not only are the structures, and their powers and vulnerabilities, basically the same, The particular contents of deliberation are probably not locked into any one level in the overall process, but can migrate. Under suitable provocation, for instance, one can dredge up some virtually subliminal consideration and elevate it for self-conscious formulation and appreciation. It becomes an intuition, and then express it so that others can consider it as well. Moving in the other direction, a reason for action perennially mentioned and debated in committee can eventually go without saying, at least out loud, but continue to shape the thinking, both of the group and the individuals, from some more subliminal base or bases of operations in the process. As Donald Campbell, 1975, and Richard Dawkins, 1976, Chapter 11, have argued, cultural institutions can sometimes be interpreted as compensations or corrections of the decisions made by natural selection. The fundamentality of satisficing, the fact that it is the basic structure of all real decision-making, moral, prudential, economic, or even evolutionary, gives birth to a familiar and troubling slipperiness of claim that bedevils theory in several quarters. To begin with, notice that merely claiming that this structure is basic is not necessarily saying that it is best, but that conclusion is certainly invited and inviting. We began this exploration, remember, by looking at a moral problem and trying to solve it. The problem of designing a good, justified, defensible, sound candidate evaluation process. Suppose we decide that the system we designed is about as good as it could be, given the constraints. A group of roughly rational agents, us, decide that this is the right way to design the process, and we have reasons for choosing the features we did. Given this genealogy, we might muster the chutzpah to declare that this is optimal design, the best of all possible designs. This apparent arrogance might have been imputed to me as soon as I set the problem. For did I not propose to examine how anyone ought to make moral decisions by examining how we, in fact, make a particular moral decision? Who are we to set the pace? Well, who else should we trust? If we can't rely on our own good judgment, it seems we can't get started. Thus, what and how we do think is evidence for the principles of rationality, what and how we ought to think. This itself is a methodological principle of rationality. Call it the fact-to-norm principle. We are implicitly accepting the fact-to-norm principle whenever we try to determine what or how we ought to think. For we must, in that very attempt, think. And unless we can think that what and how we do think there is correct, and thus is evidence for what and how we ought to think, we cannot determine what or how we ought to think. Wertheimer, 1974, pages 110 through 11. See also Goodman, 1965, page 63. Optimality claims have a way of evaporating, however. It takes no chutzpah at all to make the modest admission that this was the best solution we could come up with, given our limitations. The mistake that is sometimes made is to suppose that there is or must be a single, best or highest, perspective from which to assess ideal rationality. Does the ideally rational agent have the all-too-human problem of not being able to remember certain crucial considerations when they would be most telling, most effective in resolving a quandary? If we stipulate, as a theoretical simplification, that our imagined ideal agent is immune to such disorders, then we don't get to ask the question of what the ideal way might be to cope with them. Any such exercise presupposes that certain features, the limitations, are fixed, and other features are malleable. The latter are to be adjusted so as best to accommodate the former. But one can always change the perspective and ask about one of the presumably malleable features whether it is not, in fact, fixed in one position, a constraint to be accommodated, and one can ask about each of the fixed features whether it is something one would want to tamper with in any event. Perhaps it is for the best as it is. Addressing that question requires one to consider still further ulterior features as fixed in order to assess the wisdom of the feature under review. There is no Archimedean point here either. If we suppose the readers of the Moral First Aid Manual are complete idiots, our task is impossible. Whereas, if we suppose they are saints, our task is too easy to shed any light. This comes out graphically in the slippery assumptions about rationality in theoretical discussions of the prisoner's dilemma. There is no problem if you are entitled to assume that the players are saints. Saints always cooperate, after all. Nearsighted jerks always defect, so they are hopeless. What does the ideally rational player do? Perhaps, as some say, he sees the rationality in adopting the meta-strategy of turning himself into a less-than-ideally rational player in order to cope with the less-than-ideally rational players he knows he is apt to face. But then, in what sense is that new player less-than-ideally rational? It is a mistake to suppose this instability can be made to go away if we just think carefully enough about what ideal rationality is. That is a truly Panglossian fallacy. See the further reflections along these lines in Gibbard, 1985, and Sturgeon, 1985. 3. The Moral First Aid Manual. How, then, can we hope to regulate or at least improve our ethical decision-making if it is irredeemably heuristic, time-pressured, and myopic? Building on the parallel between what happens in the department meeting and what happens in ourselves, we can see what the meta-problems are and how they might be dealt with. We need to have alert, wise habits of thought, or in other words, colleagues who will regularly, if not infallibly, draw our attention in directions we will not regret in hindsight. There is no point having more than one colleague if they are clones of each other, all wanting to raise the same consideration. So we may suppose them to be specialists, each somewhat narrow-minded and preoccupied with protecting a certain set of interests. Minsky, 1985. Now, how shall we avert a cacophony of colleagues? We need some conversation stoppers. In addition to our timely and appropriate generators of considerations, we need consideration generator squelchers. We need some ploys that will arbitrarily terminate reflections and disquisitions by our colleagues, and cut off debate independently of the specific content of current debate. Why not just a magic word? Magic words work fine as control shifters in AI programs, but we're talking about controlling intelligent colleagues here, and they are not likely to be susceptible to magic words, as if they were under post-hypnotic suggestion. That is, good colleagues will be reflective and rational, and open-minded within the limits imposed by their specialist narrow-mindedness. If the simplest mechanisms that compose us are ballistic intentional systems, as I claimed in the previous chapter, our most sophisticated subsystems, like our actual colleagues, are indefinitely guidable intentional systems. They need to be hit with something that will appeal to their rationality while discouraging further reflection. It will not do at all for these people to be endlessly philosophizing, endlessly calling us back to first principles and demanding a justification for these apparently and actually quite arbitrary principles. What could possibly protect an arbitrary and somewhat second-rate conversation stopper from such relentless scrutiny? A meta-policy that forbids discussion and reconsideration of the conversation stoppers? But our colleagues would want to ask, Is that a wise policy? Can it be justified? It will not always yield the best results, surely, and so forth. This is a matter of delicate balance, with pitfalls on both sides. On one side, we must avoid the error of thinking that the solution is more rationality, more rules, more justifications, for there is no end to that demand. Any policy may be questioned, so, unless we provide for some brute and irrational termination of the issue, we will design a decision process that spirals fruitlessly to infinity. On the other side, no mere brute fact about the way we are built is, or should be, entirely beyond the reach of being undone by further reflection. We cannot expect there to be a single, stable solution to such a design problem, but rather a variety of uncertain and temporary equilibria, with the conversation stoppers tending to accrete pearly layers of supporting dogma, which themselves cannot withstand extended scrutiny, but do actually serve, on occasion, blessedly, to deflect and terminate consideration. Here are some promising examples. But that would do more harm than good. But that would be murder. But that would be to break a promise. But that would be to use someone merely as a means. But that would violate a person's right. Bentham once rudely dismissed the doctrine of natural and imprescriptible rights as nonsense upon stilts, and we might now reply that perhaps he was right. Perhaps talk of rights is nonsense upon stilts, but good nonsense, and good only because it is on stilts, only because it happens to have the political power to keep rising above the meta-reflections, not indefinitely, but usually high enough to reassert itself as a compelling, that is, conversation-stopping first principle. It might seem, then, that rule worship of a certain kind is a good thing, at least for agents designed like us. It is good not because there is a certain rule or set of rules which is provably the best, or which always yields the right answer, but because having rules works somewhat, and not having rules doesn't work at all. But this cannot be all there is to it. Unless we really mean worship, i.e., a rational allegiance, because just having rules or endorsing or accepting rules is no design solution at all. Having the rules, having all the information, and even having good intentions do not suffice by themselves to guarantee the right action. The agent must find all the right stuff and use it, even in the face of contrary rational challenges designed to penetrate his convictions. Having and recognizing the force of rules is not enough, and sometimes the agent is better off with less. Douglas Hofstadter draws attention to a phenomenon he calls reverberant doubt, which is stipulated out of existence in most idealized theoretical discussions. In what Hofstadter calls Wolff's dilemma, an obvious non-dilemma is turned into a serious dilemma by nothing but the passage of time and the possibility of reverberant doubt. Imagine that 20 people are selected from your high school graduation class, you among them. You don't know which others have been selected. All you know is that they are all connected to a central computer. Each of you is in a little cubicle, seated on a chair and facing one button on an otherwise blank wall. You are given 10 minutes to decide whether or not to push your button. At the end of that time, a light will go on for 10 seconds, and while it is on, you may either push or refrain from pushing. All the responses will then go to the central computer, and 1 minute later they will result in consequences. Fortunately, the consequences can only be good. If you pushed your button, you will get $100, no strings attached. If nobody pushed their button, then everybody will get $1,000. But if there was even a single button pusher, the refrainers will get nothing at all. Hofstadter, 1985, pages 752-53. Obviously, you do not push the button, right? But what if just one person were a little bit overcautious or dubious and began wondering whether this was obvious after all? Everyone should allow that this is an outside chance, and everyone should recognize that everyone should allow this. As Hofstadter notes, page 753, it is a situation in which the tiniest flicker of a doubt has become amplified into the gravest avalanche of doubt. And one of the annoying things about it is that the brighter you are, the more quickly and clearly you see what there is to fear. A bunch of amiable slowpokes might well be more likely to unanimously refrain and get the big payoff than a bunch of razor-sharp logicians who all think perversely, recursively, reverberantly. Faced with a world in which such predicaments are not unknown, we can recognize the appeal of a little old-time religion, some unquestioning dogmatism that will render agents impervious to the subtle invasions of hyper-rationality. Creating something rather like that dispositional state is indeed one of the goals of the Moral First Aid Manual, which, while we imagine it to be framed as advice to a rational, heeding audience, can also be viewed as not having achieved its end unless it has the effect of changing the operating system, not merely the data, the contents of belief or acceptance of the agents it addresses. For it to succeed in such a special task, it will have to address its target audiences with pinpoint accuracy. There might then be several different moral first aid manuals, each effective for a different type of audience. This opens up a disagreeable prospect to philosophers for two reasons. First, it suggests, contrary to their austere academic tastes, that there is reason to pay more attention to rhetoric and other only partly or impurely rational means of persuasion. The ideally rational audience to whom the ethicist may presume to address his or her reflections is yet another dubiously fruitful idealization. And more important, it suggests that what Bernard Williams, 1985, page 101, calls the ideal of transparency of a society, the working of its ethical institutions should not depend on members of the community misunderstanding how they work, is an ideal that may be politically inaccessible to us. Recoil as we may from elitist myth-making and such systematically disingenuous doctrines as the view Williams, page 108, calls government house utilitarianism, we may find, this is an open empirical possibility after all, that we will be extremely lucky to find any rational and transparent route from who we are now to who we would like to be. The landscape is rugged, and it may not be possible to get to the highest peaks from where we find ourselves today. Rethinking the practical design of a moral agent via the process of writing various versions of the Moral First Aid Manual might nevertheless allow us to make sense of some of the phenomena traditional ethical theories wave their hands about. For one thing, we might begin to understand our current moral position. By that I mean yours and mine, at this very moment. Here you are devoting several hours to listening to my audiobook, and I am no doubt doing something similar. Shouldn't we both be out raising money for Oxfam, or picketing the Pentagon, or writing letters to our senators and representatives about various matters? Did you consciously decide, on the basis of calculations, that the time was ripe for a little sabbatical from real-world engagement, a period offline for a little reading? Or was your process of decision, if that is not too grand a name for it, much more a matter of your not tampering with some current default principles that virtually ensure that you will ignore all but the most galvanizing potential interruptions to your personal life, which, I am happy to say, includes periods devoted to listening to rather difficult audiobooks? If so, Is that itself a lamentable feature or something we finite beings could not conceivably do without? Consider a traditional bench test, which most systems of ethics can pass with aplomb. Solving the problem of what you should do if you are walking along, minding your own business, and you hear a cry for help from a drowning man. That is the easy problem, a conveniently delimited, already well-framed local decision. The hard problem is, how do we get there from here? How can we justifiably find a route from our actual predicament to that relatively happy and straightforwardly decidable predicament? Our prior problem, it seems, is that every day, while trying desperately to mind our own business, we hear a thousand cries for help, complete with volumes of information on how we might oblige. How on earth could anyone prioritize that cacophony? Not by any systematic process of considering all things, weighing expected utilities, and attempting to maximize, nor by any systematic generation and testing of Kantian maxims. There are too many to consider. Yet we do get there from here. Few of us are paralyzed by such indecision for long stretches of times. By and large, we must solve this decision problem by permitting an utterly indefensible set of defaults to shield our attention from all but our current projects. Disruptions of those defaults can only occur by a process that is bound to be helter-skelter heuristics, with arbitrary and unexamined conversation stoppers bearing most of the weight. That arena of competition encourages escalations, of course. With our strictly limited capacity for attention, the problem faced by others who want us to consider their favorite consideration is essentially a problem of advertising, of attracting the attention of the well-intentioned. This competition between memes is the same problem whether we view it in the wide-scale arena of politics or in the close-up arena of personal deliberation. The role of the traditional formula of ethical discussion as directors of attention, or shapers of habits of moral imagination, as meta-memes par excellence, is thus a subject deserving further scrutiny. Chapter 17, Ethical Decision-Making Examined from the Perspective of Darwin's Dangerous Idea, holds out scant hope of our ever discovering a formula or an algorithm for doing right. But that is not an occasion for despair. We have the mind tools we need to design and redesign ourselves, ever searching for better solutions to the problems we create for ourselves and others. Chapter 18. We come to the end of this leg of our journey through design space, and take stock of what we have discovered, and consider where we might go from here. Chapter 18. The Future of an Idea. 1. In Praise of Biodiversity. God is in the details. Ludwig Mies van der Rohe, 1959. How long did it take Johann Sebastian Bach to create the St. Matthew Passion? An early version was performed in 1727 or 1729, but the version we listen to today dates from 10 years later and incorporates many revisions. How long did it take to create Johann Sebastian Bach? He had the benefit of 42 years of living when the first version was heard, and more than half a century when the later version was completed. How long did it take to create the Christianity without which the St. Matthew Passion would have been literally inconceivable by Bach or anyone else? Roughly 2 millennia. How long did it take to create the social and cultural context in which Christianity could be born? Somewhere between 100 millennia and 3 million years, depending on when we decide to date the birth of human culture. And how long did it take to create Homo sapiens? Between 3 and 4 billion years, roughly the same length of time it took to create daisies and snail darters, blue whales and spotted owls. Billions of years of irreplaceable design work. We correctly intuit a kinship between the finest productions of art and science and the glories of the biosphere. William Paley was right about one thing: our need to explain how it can be that the universe contains many wonderful designed things. Darwin's dangerous idea is that they all exist as fruits of a single tree, the tree of life, and the processes that have produced each and every one of them are, at bottom, the same. The genius exhibited by Mother Nature can be disassembled into many acts of microgenius, myopic or blind, purposeless, but capable of the most minimal sort of recognition of a good, a better thing. The genius of Bach can likewise be disassembled into many acts of microgenius, tiny mechanical transitions between brain states, generating and testing, discarding and revising and testing again. Then is Bach's brain like the proverbial monkeys at the typewriters? No, because instead of generating a vast number of alternatives, Bach's brain generated only a vanishingly small subset of all the possibilities. His genius can be measured, if you want to measure genius, in the excellence of his particular subset of generated candidates. How did he come to be able to speed so efficiently through design space, never even considering the vast neighboring regions of hopeless designs? If you want to explore that territory, just sit down at a piano and try for half an hour to compose a good new melody. His brain was exquisitely designed as a heuristic program for composing music, and the credit for that design must be shared. He was lucky in his genes. He did come from a famously musical family, and he was lucky to be born in a cultural milieu that filled his brain with the existing musical memes of the time. And no doubt he was lucky at many other moments in his life to be the beneficiary of one serendipitous convergence or another. Out of all this massive contingency came a unique cruise vehicle for exploring a portion of design space that no other vehicle could explore. No matter how many centuries or millennia of musical exploration lie ahead of us, we will never succeed in laying down tracks that make much of a mark in the vast reaches of design space. Bach is precious not because he had within his brain a magic pearl of genius stuff, a skyhook, but because he was, or contained, an utterly idiosyncratic structure of cranes, made of cranes, made of cranes, made of cranes. Like Bach, the creation of the rest of the Tree of Life differs from the monkeys at the typewriters in having explored only a vanishing subset of the vast possibilities. Efficiencies of exploration have been created again and again, and they are the cranes that have sped up the lifting over the eons. Our technology now permits us to accelerate our explorations in every part of design space, not just gene splicing, but computer-aided design of every imaginable thing, for instance, including this audiobook, which I could never have written without word processing and electronic mail. But we will never escape our finitude, or, more precisely, our tether to actuality. The Library of Babel is finite but vast, and we will never explore all its marvels, for at every point we must build, crane-like, on the bases we have constructed to date. Alert to the omnipresent risk of greedy reductionism, we might consider how much of what we value is explicable in terms of its designedness. A little intuition pumping. Which is worse, destroying somebody's project, even if it's a model of the Eiffel Tower made out of thousands of popsicle sticks, or destroying their supply of popsicle sticks? It all depends on the goal of the project. If the person just enjoys designing and redesigning, building and rebuilding, then destroying the supply of popsicle sticks is worse. Otherwise, destroying that hard-won product of design is worse. Why is it much worse to kill a condor than to kill a cow? I take it that no matter how bad you think it is to kill a cow, we agree that it is much worse to kill a condor, because the loss to our actual store of design would be so much greater if the condors went extinct. Why is it worse to kill a cow than to kill a clam? Why is it worse to kill a redwood tree than to kill an equal amount by mass of algae? Why do we rush to make high-fidelity copies of motion pictures, musical recordings, scores, books? Leonardo da Vinci's Last Supper is sadly decaying on a wall in Milan, in spite of, and sometimes because of, the efforts over the centuries to preserve it. Why would it be just as bad, maybe worse, to destroy all the old photographs of what it looked like 30 years ago as to destroy some portion of its original fabric today? These questions don't have obvious and uncontroversial answers. So the design space perspective certainly doesn't explain everything about value. But at least it lets us see what happens when we try to unify our sense of value in a single perspective. On the one hand, it helps to explain our intuition that uniqueness or individuality is intrinsically valuable. On the other hand, it lets us confirm all the incommensurabilities that people talk about. Which is worth more, a human life or the Mona Lisa? There are many who would give their lives to save the painting from destruction, and many who would sacrifice somebody else's life for it if push came to shove. Are the guards in the Louvre armed? What steps would they take if necessary? Is saving the spotted owl worth the abridgment of opportunities in the thousands of human lives affected? Once again, retrospective effects loom large. If someone has invested his life chances in becoming a logger, and now we take away the opportunity to be a logger, we devalue his investment overnight. Just as surely as, more surely in fact, than if we converted his life savings into worthless junk bonds. At what point does a human life begin or end? The Darwinian perspective lets us see with unmistakable clarity why there is no hope at all of discovering a telltale mark, a saltation in life's processes that counts. We need to draw lines. We need definitions of life and death for many important moral purposes. The layers of pearly dogma that build up in defense around these fundamentally arbitrary attempts are familiar, and in never-ending need of repair. We should abandon the fantasy that either science or religion can uncover some well-hidden fact that tells us exactly where to draw these lines. There is no natural way to mark the birth of a human soul, any more than there is a natural way to mark the birth of a species, and contrary to what many traditions insist, I think we all do share the intuition that there are gradations of value in the ending of human lives. Most human embryos end in spontaneous abortion. Fortunately, since these are mostly terrata, hopeless monsters whose lives are all but impossible, is this a terrible evil? Are the mothers whose bodies abort these embryos guilty of involuntary manslaughter? Of course not. Which is worse, taking heroic measures to keep alive a severely deformed infant, or taking the equally heroic, if unsung, step of seeing to it that such an infant dies as quickly and painlessly as possible? I do not suggest that Darwinian thinking gives us answers to such questions. I do suggest that Darwinian thinking helps us see why the traditional hope of solving these problems, finding a moral algorithm, is forlorn. We must cast off the myths that make these old-fashioned solutions seem inevitable. We need to grow up, in other words. Among the precious artifacts worth preserving are whole cultures themselves. There are still several thousand distinct languages spoken daily on our planet, but the number is dropping fast. Diamond, 1992. Hale and others, 1992. When a language goes extinct, this is the same kind of loss as the extinction of a species. And when the culture that was carried by that language dies, this is an even greater loss. But here, once again, we face incommensurabilities and no easy answers. I began this audiobook with a song which I myself cherish and hope will survive forever. I hope my grandson learns it and passes it on to his grandson. But at the same time, I do not myself believe and do not really want my grandson to believe the doctrines that are so movingly expressed in that song. They are too simple. They are, in a word, wrong. Just as wrong as the ancient Greeks' doctrines about the gods and goddesses on Mount Olympus. Do you believe, literally, in an anthropomorphic god? If not, then you must agree with me that the song is a beautiful, comforting falsehood. Is that simple song nevertheless a valuable meme? I certainly think it is. It is a modest but beautiful part of our heritage, a treasure to be preserved. But we must face the fact that, just as there were times when tigers would not have been viable, times are coming when they will no longer be viable, except in zoos and other preserves, and the same is true of many of the treasures in our cultural heritage. The Welsh language is kept alive by artificial means, just the way condors are. We cannot preserve all the features of the cultural world in which these treasures flourished. We wouldn't want to. It took oppressive political and social systems, rife with many evils, to create the rich soil in which many of our greatest works of art could grow. Slavery and despotism, enlightened though these sometimes may have been, obscene differences in living standards between the rich and the poor, and a huge amount of ignorance. Ignorance is a necessary condition for many excellent things. The childish joy of seeing what Santa Claus has brought for Christmas is a species of joy that must soon be extinguished in each child by the loss of ignorance. When that child grows up, she can transmit that joy to her own children. But she must also recognize a time when it has outlived its value. The view I am expressing has clear ancestors. The philosopher George Santayana was a Catholic atheist, if you can imagine such a thing. According to Bertrand Russell, 1945, page 811, William James once denounced Santayana's ideas as the perfection of rottenness, and one can see why some people would be offended by his brand of aestheticism. A deep appreciation for all the formula, ceremonies, and trappings of his religious heritage, but lacking the faith. Santayana's position was aptly caricatured. There is no God, and Mary is his mother. But how many of us are caught in that very dilemma, loving the heritage, firmly convinced of its value, yet unable to sustain any conviction at all in its truth? We are faced with a difficult choice. Because we value it, we are eager to preserve it in a rather precarious and denatured state, in churches and cathedrals and synagogues, built to house huge congregations of the devout, and now on the way to being cultural museums. There is really not that much difference between the roles of the beef-eaters who stand picturesque guard at the Tower of London and the cardinals who march in their magnificent costumes and meet to elect the next pope. Both are keeping alive traditions, rituals, liturgies, symbols that otherwise would fade. But hasn't there been a tremendous rebirth of fundamentalist faith in all these creeds? Yes, unfortunately there has been. And I think that there are no forces on this planet more dangerous to us all than the fanaticisms of fundamentalism, of all the species. Protestantism, Catholicism, Judaism, Islam, Hinduism, and Buddhism, as well as countless smaller infections. Is there a conflict between science and religion here? There most certainly is. Darwin's dangerous idea helps to create a condition in the memosphere that in the long run threatens to be just as toxic to these memes as civilization in general has been toxic to the large wild mammals. Save the elephants, yes, of course, but not by all means. not by forcing the people of Africa to live 19th century lives, for instance. This is not an idle comparison. The creation of the great wildlife preserves in Africa has often been accompanied by the dislocation and ultimate destruction of human populations. For a chilling vision of this side effect, see Colin Turnbull, 1972, on the fate of the Eek. Those who think that we should preserve the elephant's pristine environment at all costs should contemplate the costs of returning the United States to the pristine conditions in which the buffaloes roam and the deer and the antelope play. We must find an accommodation. I love the King James Version of the Bible. My own spirit recoils from a God who is he or she. In the same way, my heart sinks when I see a lion pacing neurotically back and forth in a small zoo cage. I know, the lion is beautiful but dangerous. If you let the lion roam free, it would kill me. Safety demands that it be put in a cage. Safety demands that religions be put in cages too, when absolutely necessary. We just can't have forced female circumcision. And the second-class status of women in Roman Catholicism and Mormonism, to say nothing of their status in Islam. The recent Supreme Court ruling declaring unconstitutional the Florida law prohibiting the sacrificing of animals in the rituals of the Santeria sect, an Afro-Caribbean religion incorporating elements of Yoruba traditions and Roman Catholicism, is a borderline case, at least for many of us. Such rituals are offensive to many, but the protective mantle of religious tradition secures our tolerance. We are wise to respect these traditions. It is, after all, just part of respect for the biosphere. Save the Baptists. Yes, of course, but not by all means. Not if it means tolerating the deliberate misinforming of children about the natural world. According to a recent poll, 48% of the people in the United States today believe that the book of Genesis is literally true. And 70% believe that creation science should be taught in school alongside evolution. Some recent writers recommended a policy in which parents would be able to opt out of materials they didn't want their children taught. Should evolution be taught in the schools? Should arithmetic be taught? Should history? Misinforming a child is a terrible offense. A faith, like a species, must evolve or go extinct when the environment changes. It is not a gentle process in either case. We see in every Christian subspecies the battle of memes. Should women be ordained? Should we go back to the Latin liturgy? And the same can also be observed in the varieties of Judaism and Islam. We must have a similar mixture of respect and self-protective caution about memes. This is already accepted practice, but we tend to avert our attention from its implications. We preach freedom of religion, but only so far. If your religion advocates slavery or mutilation of women or infanticide, or puts a price on Salman Rushdie's head because he has insulted it, then your religion has a feature that cannot be respected. It endangers us all. It is nice to have grizzly bears and wolves living in the wild. They are no longer a menace. We can peacefully coexist with a little wisdom. The same policy can be discerned in our political tolerance, in religious freedom. You are free to preserve or create any religious creed you wish, so long as it does not become a public menace. We're all on earth together, and we have to learn some accommodation. The Hutterite memes are clever not to include any memes about the virtue of destroying outsiders. If they did, we would have to combat them. We tolerate the Hutterites because they harm only themselves, though we may well insist that we have the right to impose some further openness on their schooling of their own children. Other religious memes are not so benign. The message is clear. Those who will not accommodate, who will not temper, who insist on keeping only the purest and wildest strain of their heritage alive, we will be obliged reluctantly to cage or disarm, and we will do our best to disable the memes they fight for. Slavery is beyond the pale. Child abuse is beyond the pale. Discrimination is beyond the pale. The pronouncing of death sentences on those who blaspheme against a religion, complete with bounties or rewards for those who carry them out, is beyond the pale. It is not civilized, and it is owed no more respect in the name of religious freedom than any other incitement to cold-blooded murder. Those of us who lead fulfilling, even exciting lives should hardly be shocked to see people in the disadvantaged world, and indeed in the drabber corners of our own world, turning to fanaticism of one brand or another. Would you settle docilely for a life of meaningless poverty, knowing what you know today about the world? The technology of the infosphere has recently made it conceivable for everybody on the globe to know roughly what you know, with a lot of distortion. Until we can provide an environment for all people in which fanaticism doesn't make sense, we can expect more and more of it. But we don't have to accept it, and we don't have to respect it. Taking a few tips from Darwinian medicine, Williams and Ness, 1991, we can take steps to conserve what is valuable in every culture without keeping alive, or virulent, all its weaknesses. We can appreciate the bellicosity of the Spartans without wanting to reintroduce it. We can marvel at the systems of atrocities instituted by the Mayans without for one moment regretting the extinction of those practices. It must be scholarship, not human game preserves, ethnic or religious states under dictatorships, that saves superannuated cultural artifacts for posterity. Attic, Greek, and Latin are no longer living languages, but scholarship has preserved the art and literature of ancient Greece and Rome. Petrarch, in the 14th century, bragged about the volumes of Greek philosophy he had in his personal library. He couldn't read them because the knowledge of ancient Greek had all but disappeared from the world in which he lived. But he knew their value and strove to restore the knowledge that would unlock their secrets. Long before there was science or even philosophy, there were religions. They have served many purposes. It would be a mistake of greedy reductionism to look for a single purpose, a single summum bonum, which they have all directly or indirectly served. They have inspired many people to lead lives that have added immeasurably to the wonders of our world. And they have inspired many more people to lead lives that were, given their circumstances, more meaningful, less painful than they otherwise could have been. Bruegel's painting, The Fall of Icarus, shows a plowman and a horse on a hillside in the foreground, a handsome sailing ship way in the background, and two almost unnoticeable white legs disappearing with a tiny splash into the sea. The painting inspired W.H. Auden to write one of my favorite poems, Musée des Beaux-Arts. About suffering, they were never wrong. The old masters, how well they understood its human position, how it takes place while someone else is eating or opening a window or just walking dully along, how, when the aged are reverently, passionately waiting for the miraculous birth, there always must be children who did not specially want it to happen, skating on a pond at the edge of the wood. They never forgot that even the dreadful martyrdom must run its course. Anyhow, in a corner, some untidy spot, where the dogs go on with their doggy life and the torturer's horse scratches its innocent behind on a tree. In Bruegel's Icarus, for instance, how everything turns away quite leisurely from the disaster. The plowman may have heard the splash, the forsaken cry. But for him it was not an important failure. The sun shone as it had to on the white legs disappearing into the green water, and the expensive, delicate ship that must have seen something amazing, a boy falling out of the sky, had somewhere to get to. and sailed calmly on. That is our world, and the suffering in it matters, if anything does. Religions have brought the comfort of belonging and companionship to many who would otherwise have passed through this life all alone, without glory or adventure. At their best, religions have drawn attention to love and made it real for people who could not otherwise see it, and ennobled the attitudes and refreshed the spirits of the world beset. Another thing religions have accomplished, without this being thereby their raison d'être, is that they have kept Homo sapiens civilized enough for long enough for us to have learned how to reflect more systematically and accurately on our position in the universe. There is much more to learn. There is certainly a treasury of ill-appreciated truths embedded in the endangered cultures of the modern world, designs that have accumulated details over eons of idiosyncratic history, and we should take steps to record it and study it before it disappears, for, like dinosaur genomes, once it is gone, it will be virtually impossible to recover. We should not expect this variety of respect to be satisfactory to those who wholeheartedly embody the memes we honor with our attentive, but not worshipful, scholarship. On the contrary, many of them will view anything other than enthusiastic conversion to their own views as a threat, even an intolerable threat. We must not underestimate the suffering such confrontations cause. To watch, to have to participate in, the contraction or evaporation of beloved features of one's heritage is a pain only our species can experience. And surely few pains could be more terrible. But we have no reasonable alternative. And those whose visions dictate that they cannot peacefully coexist with the rest of us, we will have to quarantine as best we can, minimizing the pain and damage, trying always to leave open a path or two that may come to seem acceptable. If you want to teach your children that they are the tools of God, you had better not teach them that they are God's rifles, or we will have to stand firmly opposed to you. Your doctrine has no glory, no special rights, no intrinsic and inalienable merit. If you insist on teaching your children falsehoods, that the earth is flat, that man is not a product of evolution by natural selection, then you must expect, at the very least, that those of us who have freedom of speech will feel free to describe your teachings as the spreading of falsehoods, and will attempt to demonstrate this to your children at our earliest opportunity. Our future well-being, the well-being of all of us on the planet, depends on the education of our descendants. What then of all the glories of our religious traditions? They should certainly be preserved, as should the languages, the art, the costumes, the rituals, the monuments. Zoos are now more and more being seen as second-class havens for endangered species, but at least they are havens, and what they preserve is irreplaceable. The same is true of complex memes and their phenotypic expressions. Many a fine New England church, costly to maintain, is in danger of destruction. Shall we deconsecrate these churches and turn them into museums, or retrofit them for some other use? The latter fate is at least to be preferred to their destruction. Many congregations face a cruel choice. Their house of worship costs so much to maintain in all its splendor that little of their tithing is left over for the poor. The Catholic Church has faced this problem for centuries and has maintained a position that is, I think, defensible, but not obviously so. When it spends its treasure to put gold plating on the candlesticks, instead of providing more food and better shelter for the poor of the parish, it has a different vision of what makes life worth living. Our people, it says, benefit more from having a place of splendor in which to worship than from a little more food. Any atheist or agnostic who finds this cost-benefit analysis ludicrous might pause to consider whether to support diverting all charitable and governmental support for museums, symphony orchestras, libraries, and scientific laboratories to efforts to provide more food and better living conditions for the least well-off. A human life worth living is not something that can be uncontroversially measured, and that is its glory. And there's the rub. What will happen, one may well wonder, if religion is preserved in cultural zoos, in libraries, in concerts and demonstrations? It is happening. The tourists flock to watch the Native American tribal dances, and for the onlookers, it is folklore, a religious ceremony, certainly to be treated with respect, but also an example of a meme complex on the verge of extinction, at least in its strong ambulatory phase. It has become an invalid, barely kept alive by its custodians. Does Darwin's dangerous idea give us anything in exchange for the ideas it calls into question? In Chapter 3, I quoted the physicist Paul Davies, proclaiming that the reflective power of human minds can be no trivial detail, no minor byproduct of mindless, purposeless forces, and suggested that being a byproduct of mindless, purposeless forces was no disqualification for importance. And I have argued that Darwin has shown us how, in fact, everything of importance is just such a product. Spinoza called his highest being God or nature, Deus sive natura, expressing a sort of pantheism. There have been many varieties of pantheism, but they usually lack a convincing explanation about just how God is distributed in the whole of nature. As we talked about in Chapter 7, Darwin offers us one. It is in the distribution of design throughout nature, creating in the tree of life an utterly unique and irreplaceable creation, an actual pattern in the immeasurable reaches of design space that could never be exactly duplicated in its many details. What is design work? It is that wonderful wedding of chance and necessity, happening in a trillion places at once, at a trillion different levels. And what miracle caused it? None. It just happened to happen in the fullness of time. You could even say, in a way, that the tree of life created itself. Not in a miraculous, instantaneous whoosh, but slowly, slowly over billions of years. Is this tree of life a god one could worship? Pray to? Fear? Probably not. But it did make the ivy twine and the sky so blue, so perhaps the song I love tells a truth after all. The tree of life is neither perfect nor infinite in space or time, but it is actual. And if it is not Anselm's being greater than which nothing can be conceived, it is surely a being that is greater than anything any of us will ever conceive of, in detail, worthy of its detail. Is something sacred? Yes, I say with Nietzsche. I could not pray to it, but I can stand in affirmation of its magnificence. This world is sacred. 2. Universal acid. Handle with care. There is no denying at this point that Darwin's idea is a universal solvent, capable of cutting right to the heart of everything in sight. The question is, what does it leave behind? I have tried to demonstrate that once it passes through everything, we are left with stronger, sounder versions of our most important ideas. Some of the traditional details perish, and some of these are losses to be regretted. But good riddance to the rest of them. What remains is more than enough to build on. At every stage in the tumultuous controversies that have accompanied the evolution of Darwin's dangerous idea, there has been a defiance born of fear. You'll never explain this. And the challenge has been taken up. Watch me. And in spite of, indeed partly because of, the huge emotional investments the opponents have made in winning their sides of the argument, the picture has become clearer and clearer. We now have a much better sense of what a Darwinian algorithm is than Darwin ever dreamt of. Intrepid reverse engineering has brought us to the point where we can confidently assess rival claims about exactly what happened where on this planet billions of years ago. The miracles of life and consciousness turn out to be even better than we imagined back when we were sure they were inexplicable. The ideas expressed in this audiobook are just the beginning. This has been an introduction to Darwinian thinking. Sacrificing details again and again to provide a better appreciation of the overall shape of Darwin's idea. But as Mies van der Rohe said, God is in the details. I urge caution alongside the enthusiasm I hope I have kindled in you. I have learned from my own embarrassing experience how easy it is to concoct remarkably persuasive Darwinian explanations that evaporate on closer inspection. The truly dangerous aspect of Darwin's idea is its seductiveness. Second-rate versions of the fundamental ideas continue to bedevil us, so we must keep a close watch, correcting each other as we go. The only way of avoiding the mistakes is to learn from the mistakes we have already made. A meme that occurs in many guises in the world's folklore is the tale of the initially terrifying friend mistaken for an enemy. Beauty and the Beast is one of the best-known species of this story. Balancing it is the wolf in sheep's clothing. Now, which meme do you want to use to express your judgment of Darwinism? Is it truly a wolf in sheep's clothing? Then reject it and fight on, ever more vigilant against the seductions of Darwin's idea, which is truly dangerous. Or does Darwin's idea turn out to be, in the end, just what we need in our attempt to preserve and explain the values we cherish? I have completed my case for the defense. The Beast is, in fact, a friend of beauty, and indeed quite beautiful in its own right. You be the judge. This has been an Audible Inc. production of Darwin's Dangerous Idea, Evolution and the Meanings of Life, written by Daniel C. Dennett, narrated by Kevin Stillwell, producer Mike Charzik, copyright 1995 by Daniel C. Dennett, production copyright 2013 by Audible Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.